Okay, I think I've got my guest here. Do I have Werner here?
Yep.
Okay, I've got Werner Bach. And
yes, that's me.
And he's my guest for the evening, and I'm going to let Werner give a little information about himself. And before I get started here, too, the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHIN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And all the programs are archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. And again, Werner, I'll go ahead and let you introduce yourself.
Look, I can barely understand you.
Really? Okay, let me see if I can...
If you can tune it up a little bit.
Is that help any?
Well, maybe a little bit more, if it's possible.
Okay. Let's see. Well, how does that work?
Well, I guess you have to get along with what we got.
Okay, I'm sorry, but I've got my...
Can you understand me?
Yeah, I can understand you fine. And
okay, good. Well, I was kind of surprised there about a week and a half ago when you called me up. But at the same time, I'm glad because I figure the word has to come out, get out, what has driven a lot of farmers and ranchers off the land. We basically have been under attack now for many years. And a good part of the mainstream media, they have played quite a dubious role
against
the farmers off the land.
But Werner, let me tell them where you're located too,
I'm living here in eastern Canada in New Brunswick, and I immigrated here in early 1969 from the old country, from Germany. And, the name New Brunswick sounds familiar because where I was living over there in Germany, it was under the Duke of Brunswick at one time, you know.
Okay.
But there was no premeditation or so when I came here. And the terrain, it looks about similar to where I come from, you know. It's a beautiful province. At one time, they used to have one there. On their license plates, the name New Brunswick is a picture province.
Uh-huh.
But what they've been doing over the last 50, 60 years, they have created a lot of scars in this beautiful picture by what they've done in the forestry, clear-cutting of massive tracts of forest land, and basically the successive governments have handed most of the forest land lock, stock, and barrel over to the big companies, especially one big company, and that is Irving here in New Brunswick. It's basically a family-run business, and now over the last few decades, they've expanded along the eastern seaboard in Maine and further down. They have, I think it's the biggest oil refinery here on the East Coast, plus they got basically now nearly the monopoly on the forestry.
Okay, now you came over to the U.S. in what year? Because, I mean, you're from Germany, right?
Yeah, I came over in 1969.
Okay, so you've got several different things that I'd like to cover in this program, but one of them is how you initially got involved
basically become an activist?
Yes, there you go.
Well, as I say, you know, you don't know what's floating in the murky river until you get thrown into the water.
Right.
You know?
Uh-huh.
And then when you're thrashing around in that river, because you encounter all kind of nasty critters, and then the people that watch you from the banks, they think, what's that crazy fella doing there?
So you got started because of what was happening with your...
Well, after I had been here for 5 years and I'd done a lot of hard work in order to get the land back into production, and here the government was looking at the time for immigrant farmers because huge tracts of good farmland, what we consider to be good farmland, had been abandoned. And we were being told by the government, the people, they are lazy. They don't want to farm anymore. It's too much hard work, not enough money, you know. But within a few years, I found out that it wasn't that the people were lazy while the land had been abandoned. I found out that there was an annual ritual. Whenever I had a crop planted and it was coming up, then a small plane would show up, make a few passes over the field, and within a few days, grain crop would either die out completely or be badly damaged so as to not make it any more economically viable. And I was familiar, and we farmers over from the old country, we were familiar with the agricultural chemicals, especially the herbicides that had been already for decades in use over there. But then when I encountered the massive cover-up by the provincial Department of Agriculture, by the Department of Environment, I got kind of furious, and I looked at most of the farmers that had been farming here and that basically had abandoned the land. They did not know what kind of hell could be raised with those modern agricultural chemicals. And they had been deceived by government agencies for decades, forced them into unsustainable practices, and when we were, grazing cattle, so that we had to plow up our hay ground every 3 or 4 years and reseed it, and, with immense expenses. And it put lots of money into the pockets of the local business community, into the farm machinery dealers, into the fuel companies, into the seed companies. But the farmers were going broke.
Okay.
And then from the from the early 70s, another thing what I noticed, there was a deliberate introduction of new weeds into the farmland, especially into the cropland, that basically made it necessary to use the herbicides.
You're saying that
not just only weeds, but plant pests.
Are you saying that weeds were introduced that didn't used to be there and they didn't...
From the mid-70s, some weeds I was familiar with from the old country, suddenly they showed up here. And they showed up in a pattern. Most of the time when the weeds showed up, they showed up nice and even over the whole field. After I'd seen a couple weeks earlier, for example, a military jet, flying at quite an altitude over the field. Or they would show up in swathes, 8, 10, or 12 feet wide. Just depends, when you got one of those hand crank spreaders. Just depends on the velocity of the seed. If you got a seed that has that's coarse and has more weight, so you get a wider swath. And those weeds, they were being put out together with a selective herbicide that would kill the existing crop, be it a grain crop or be it a hay crop. Would kill off either the grain or the timothy and the productive forage plants and the clovers.
Okay, now, Werner, I'm talking to Werner Bach, and he lives up in New Brunswick, Canada. But were there other people that were noticing this, or were you just noticing this by yourself?
Look, when I, I came into a new country. I came into a new continent.
Uh-huh.
And you have to go on a steep learning curve. You have to learn fast. You have to be very observing. And a lot of those things that happened here, they sneaked on slowly to most of the farmers. They didn't even recognize it. Plus they didn't have the background about chemicals, agricultural chemicals, because most of the farmers had been farming here organically and sustainable.
So, what kind of answers did you get? Did you start asking questions, and what kind of answers did you get if you did?
Well, the saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
Right.
From 1981, I followed up through the Department of Agriculture and through the Department of the Environment. The field people that came out here, they acknowledged the damage. And then we looked at the damage pattern, we narrowed it down to maybe three different type of herbicides or chemicals that could have been used to do the damage. They take the samples, and then they send them to the lab in Fredericton, our provincial capital. And they said we do tests on those chemicals. And then they did tests that didn't apply at all, you know. Or they threw the samples out.
They didn't.
Or they let the samples sit for months unrefrigerated in the office before they did some tests. But by that time, the culprit, the chemical they were looking for, had degraded.
Did they not try to attribute it to some kind of fungus or some kind of bug?
No, this had nothing to do with the fungus.
Okay, so so there wasn't other conditions that they tried to blame it on.
They couldn't. And basically, with this, most of the time, the chemicals that were used were vegetation control chemicals, a la Agent Orange.
Okay.
Who had been used in large amounts at Canadian Armed Forces Base, Gagetown. It's just only about 70 miles as a crow flies from here. And on several occasions, I saw a military plane coming from Gagetown, making the pass over the field or alongside the field, upwind, you know, and then they would bank again and head it back to Gagetown. And then within a few days, everything would stop growing in the field.
So you
went dormant for a month and a half. But the chemicals that had been for decades dumped on the ground, they basically were very detrimental to the microbial life in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And when you upset the microbial balance in the soil and you got those toxins in the soil, then all bets are off. Then you get the because the microbial balance isn't there anymore, where the good, you know, keep the balance against the bad ones in the soil, like fungi, you know, some harmful fungi and so. So that sets the whole apple cart. And this might be of interest to your listeners. I spoke there about 3 months ago to a researcher, Dr. Don Huber.
Oh, yes, I've interviewed him, yes.
Yeah, and he basically came to the same conclusion what I had learned when I went over the old country in the 60s when I went to agriculture college.
Well, didn't he also work around these chemicals, so he was familiar with them?
Yeah, as I say, you know, he grew up on a dairy farm, and then he took a career in working as a scientist for the Department of Agriculture, and his specialty was microbial life in the soil.
And he was familiar with the glyphosates.
Yeah, he was familiar with the glyphosate, and he pointed out that it does a lot of damage, the buildup of those chemicals. It destroys the healthy microbial life in the soil. But here comes another aspect in. This microbial, the aerobic bacteria in the upper 6 or 8 inches of the soil, they are basically a biological water filter, too. Toxins get broken down. Waste products get broken down. And manure, in that it gets recycled and made available to the vegetation that's grown on top of the ground. But when you seriously interfere with that balance in the soil, then this biological water filter does not work anymore.
Right.
And it has a strong sterilizing effect on the soil, too. So, for example, nitrogen, it does not, for example, for manure, it does not get converted and made available to the vegetation, but it becomes water soluble, ends up in the groundwater. Plus all the pollution. It does not get broken down and ends up in the groundwater. But now over the last 30, 40 years, we deal with a way more dangerous form of pollution, and that is all those man-made chemicals. Where they're in the natural system. No, the natural system is not adapted to deal with those man-made chemicals. basically, they've created a whole Pandora's box.
Now, are you familiar with Percy Schmeiser then?
Yeah, I spoke to Percy Schmeiser the first time I heard about 6 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Against Monsanto. And at the time when the last judgment by the Supreme Court of Canada, when they decided against Mr. Schmeiser, I spoke to people in the media and I said, you fellas, you should be looking into those judges at the Supreme Court of Canada. They should reveal their financial interests, like in their pension funds and in their private investment portfolios. There's a good chance that they, either in their pension funds or in their private investment portfolios, that they are financially involved with Monsanto. I said I can vouch for. They don't have any financial interest in Percy Schmeiser's farm.
Yeah. I'm sure. So,
you know, what I've seen. That's the way Monsanto is getting away with bullying their way through the judicial system.
How many years did you have to deal with this, or did you give up? What happened?
This is still going on because nobody's picking it up. I've made the rounds with the mainstream media. I've made the rounds with members of parliament, with ministers, with deputy ministers, with environmental organizations. I'm saying always all lights are flashing, all bells are ringing, but there's nobody there to do the job.
Do you get any kind of a good response from them, or does it...
Initially, they wanted to blow me off, but then when they realized the seriousness of the situation, then they turned scared. Because this has been going on for a long while to prepare the way for globalization.
Right. Now,
and I looked at the situation, for example, here on the East Coast and in many parts of North America. It's the same situation. The regions that at one time were self-sufficient in food production. And I reasoned, if I would be one of those big business tycoons, or if I would belong to a group of those business tycoons,
mm-hmm.
I would try to do anything I could to destroy this system of self-sufficiency. Because at the time when regions were self-sufficient locally and so... excuse me. A lot of the goods and services were changing hands in a barter system. There was very little money in for big business, and there was very little money in for big government. So that system had to be destroyed. Regions that were self-sufficient had to be made deficient and hopefully produce the needs of that region halfway around the world, if possible with slave labor, or buy it up for pittance, because in that the other part of the world it's been produced at a surplus. And I remember there years ago there was a situation in Australia where the farmers, after they had shipped their cattle, a few weeks later they got a bill from the trucking company. They still owed the money. And there was a similar situation, but I understand, in the dirty 30s, out west, when the farmers out west, when they had shipped their grain, 4 weeks later they got a bill from the railroad. They still owed money.
So in other words, they just let the people work and then they would just take it from them.
Yeah, basically speculators, mm-hmm. you know, at the grain exchange, Chicago, you know, exchange and so, they were making a fortune, and they were bankrupting the farmers. And here I want to point out, look, over the last while I got through quite a learning curve, and thanks to the internet, I still speak German, I had access to the original archives, and from what my parents and the people over in the old country who went through that time, pre-National Socialist, and that was about the very same situation over there in Germany.
So in other words, you're saying what was happening over here
was dying, and now North America, especially on your side of the border, your country is dying.
You see the same practices taking place?
Yeah.
Okay. So now, was it just, how much land did you farm?
Well, I bought this farm And as I say, you know, I didn't think I would intrude onto anyone. The farm had been on the market for over a year, and I figured if any one of the local people wanted the farm, you know, they could have bought it, you know.
Right.
And it's about 330 acres of farmland, but I had to clean up a lot of the fields. You know, they started growing up in all the bushes. And I had to do a lot of drainage work, putting ditches in and tile drain and lime the ground. And after I put the hard work in, that's when the local clique figured they could run me out. They could run me off.
Uh-huh.
And then they, then from one of the so-called good church-going ladies, she said to me, oh, the land was granted to our forefathers for all times. And I said, how about when they sell it? Oh, it belongs to them anyway. I said, that's nice. And I'm stuck with a 25-year mortgage. You know, if you want to have those kind of laws on the book, put them on the book, you know.
Uh-huh.
And not spring it on immigrants. But as I say, this what this is basically is a criminal network.
So welcome to the real world here of
well,
what goes on out there.
I got quite a wake-up call. You know, I was too naive, you know.
Uh-huh.
But in the meantime, over the last 37 years, I tried to wake up as many people as possible. But most of the people, they're about over 30 years ago, they basically were telling me, oh, don't knock it. We never might get it as good again. But at what price? They've been selling your country on your side of the border and here on the northern side of the border ever since they've been selling it out from underneath the people. Successive governments. In order so they could keep on partying, keep the party going.
So, now, did you just stay in raising crops or did you have cattle?
Well, initially, I started growing grain and I started raising pigs. But it takes a lot of investment, and anybody who has been dealing with pigs, if you don't have everything properly set up, pigs can drive you up the wall. You know, they're very industrious, you know,
uh-huh.
And very inquiring, and you need good gates and everything set up, you know. So... then in 1974, my dad had passed away the year earlier. He left me a piece of ground, so I figured I would go into beef cattle for a while, and that would leave me time to get the other things set up, you know.
Uh-huh.
But as soon as the cattle trucks rolled into the yard, some of the neighbors who saw it already a few years earlier that I was a goner, suddenly they wanted to be friends with me again.
So what was that all about?
Pardon?
What was that all about then?
Especially this one family, but it wasn't that they wanted to be friends. They wanted to know what was going on. And then within three-quarter of a year, that's when they started messing around with my cattle. Cattle died with symptoms of poisoning, hushed up by veterinarians. And this bunch was harassing me, and a whole bunch of young fellas, you know, from town. And they figured they could run me off. But as I say, I was all alone, and I worked things my way. And I had steered up too much of a stink and too much of an embarrassment for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. So up in order to shut me up on false accusations. I was supposed to have threatened one of that clique with a gun. I was being picked up and put in the loony bin. I didn't have a gun. When the trouble started up, and trouble with the telephone started up, like I'd seen years earlier in a movie,
uh-huh.
You know, I figured it's more than a local clique, you know, and I figured... better get rid of your gun, because a few months earlier, another farmer just only 10 miles away, he had been found shot in his barn. And there were a lot of rumors going around that it was about real estate. And that's when I had to consider that my farm, I have roughly about 3.5 miles of road frontage overlooking a nice valley. And I figured that was worth a pretty penny.
So what...
Well, basically, I want to sum it up.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, some young fellas, they got financed by someone with money behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then there was some hanky-panky going on with the provincial government about the handing out of farm loans. You know, there was some fraud going on.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't fit in there because I didn't buy my farm with the provincial lending agency, but with the federal lending agency, the Farm Credit Corporation. And they got stung before me by a fella who had the farm for 8 years. They had financed him and everything. He sold all the livestock. He cut all the lumber that could be cut. There are over 300 acres of woodland. And the last herd of cattle, he sold to the state so the government wouldn't get the money. And then he threw the land back at the government. And during the 8 years, he never paid a penny of property tax.
So what did that work in your favor or against you? What?
But as I say, look, this is some of the background.
Uh-huh.
But we got so many fires burning all over North America. And,
yeah, but I'm trying to tie this into with, you know, people being able to recognize, you know, that this sort of thing happens here as well, that there's somebody after
well,
the land.
Well, as I say, you know, what I understood there a little bit over a year ago, there are about 70 ranches under the gun there in Colorado where the government wants the land, government
uh-huh.
or developers. They want to get the ranches off the land.
Right, right.
And they're coming up with all kinds of, I regret to say, some of the humane societies, many of the humane societies, have played a very dubious role. So the veterinarians. I spoke to Nick Striegel. Last year he was the state veterinarian in Colorado, and I spoke to Scott Dutcher.
Mm-hmm.
And I made them the material available because I had come across there from Vernon Wagner's cattle, and when I saw the pictures where 400 head were pent up in the salida in the stockyard, and I saw the condition of the cattle, and it looked exactly like some of my cattle when they had survived the attacks.
Yeah, but my understanding is, after talking to some people involved in that, there was a little more problems on his side where you apparently didn't have this going on with your cattle, right?
Well, what I understood when I was looking into and speaking to Mr. Wagner,
uh-huh.
it was a severe winter.
Right.
And a little bit over 100 cows, they went on the other side of the mountain and they couldn't get to them.
Right.
You know, and you know, with that so severe, very cold temperatures, you know, you can't stay too long outside, you know.
Uh-huh.
And when they then finally found the cattle, you know, most of them were dead. But what I'd seen here, the criminals behind, they were using always some kind of an excuse where they figured they could blame it on any kind of adverse condition, be it with the fields or be it with the animals. But in my case, they couldn't make it stick.
So
and I've been basically now for the last 37 years have been attacking them.
Okay,
and
so
now they don't return any more calls or anything.
So what did you go with your cattle, though? You went through some things that was a little different, right?
Well, basically, I started when I came across the cover up by the veterinarian as early as 1975. And the basically the professional misconduct, not just only misconduct, basically the cover-up by the local veterinarian to cover up what was the cause of death to the animals. When he deliberately discarded the evidence after he had acknowledged probably some kind of poisoning when I pointed out to him massive hemorrhaging of the heart muscle. He discarded part of the evidence, and then the tissue sample, he deliberately contaminated it by dipping it into a puddle of dirty water.
Okay. Because one of the...
They figured they could blame it on some kind of a pathogen, but they couldn't make a pathogen responsible for. But anyway, this was a wild week, and I got all alone thrust into it. And I basically had, well, you know, the experience I had and what I encountered there, it was something I'd seen before, some of it in movies. You know? So I had to think on my feet and deal with it accordingly. And it became too embarrassing for the RCMP when one afternoon, when this clique thought they could intimidate me and scare me, and I put them on a wild goose chase on the highway. You know? The next morning, I had a visit from two high-ranking officers. "You're doing an awful lot of driving lately." I replied, "Why? Are there any restrictions for immigrants how much driving they can do?" I said, "What do you want? My car is licensed. I got my driver's license. What do you want?" So one of the officers said, "What do you think how it would make us look when you find all those things out and we don't?"
So there, in other words, they're worried about you making them look bad, huh?
Yeah, that's what it was all about. But at the time, there was a politically pretty unstable situation. Then 1975, you probably remember there, here on the East Coast, Northeast, and at the time then Quebec, Canada, was about to split up, you know, the FLQ crisis.
Right.
And then there were some forces at work that wanted, here on the East Coast, that wanted to form a maritime union, you know? And with what was being done and the influence that was peddled behind the scene, I started putting some things together. And I think at the time I threw a monkey wrench in for them.
Okay, and I'm talking to Werner Bach, and he lives in New Brunswick, Canada. And he's just giving some of his background information and experience with agriculture and livestock, raising livestock in Canada. But what he's trying to kind of bring across that there's things like that taking place here, and he just got wise to it a little bit earlier, right?
Yeah, and I had to pay the price for it. But then afterwards, when I basically put the gun to their, you know, put them under the gun, the last word I got from the RCMP was, "You can sue us. We won't tell you why we picked you up."
So what you're saying is that they, who do you think wants the land?
I mean, a local clique. That's what it started out with. And in the mid-70s, a bad bunch came in. When they wanted something what you had to give it to them or step aside. And I was being told by people in government, they can get pretty nasty, you know? Or you can fight City Hall. But this is more than City Hall. There was an agenda behind. And I think this is playing out now more and more about where there's a corruption in all the branches of government, you know, it's like a cancer, it's in everywhere. Organized crime.
Right.
And where the most money is, that's where the most organized crime is.
So...
And the most money is, one of the places where most of the money is war. Military industrial sector. Then you have the pharmaceutical. Then you have Monsanto, you know, where they basically want to redo all life forms on this planet. They will be able, they hope they will be able to control then all life on this planet. Basically, see, plain God, the old Babylonian spirit. Let us be gods.
So you've been studying quite a bit of this since you ran into this taking place around you. in agriculture. What do the other farmers do in your area? Do they sell out? Do they give up?
Well, most of the farmers, they just plain quit.
Uh-huh.
You know, and as I say, now I'm 50 or 70 years old, and I'm the oldest farmer in the valley here.
But there are some farmers still left.
Well, some of them, they went into farming because they had some money in the kitty. They had been working for the government, you know, mm-hmm. or they were into other business. And so they started farming, and I've seen them coming in there from the mid-70s on. They didn't have any farming background. And one by one, most of them, they petered out. After a few years, they just plain gave up.
Okay.
They realized farming wasn't as easy as they thought it was.
Well, was there any kind of incentives that they thought were going to work for them when they came in, and then they found out that those, even with those incentives, it wasn't worth their while to
well, as I say, you know, a few years ago, our cattle prices here in the East, in Eastern Canada, they were the lowest cattle prices since 1949. But our expenses have gone up more than tenfold.
Uh-huh.
And the only way that I could survive with all the losses and everything, I cut things right down to a shoestring budget. And most of the machinery I got, I built it on my own. I wasn't tied down with big machinery payments. You know?
Uh-huh.
This is what I'd seen over in the old country. That took a lot of farmers under, you know. But now you got some of those big farms that had been over the last 30, 40 years had access to all the government grants and subsidies, you know,
mm-hmm.
in the millions of dollars, and they're looking pretty now. But how can we compete with our own tax money?
That's kind of tough, and it's kind of, yeah, I mean, what you're talking about, it looks like that the farmers and ranchers kind of experienced is somewhat like if you'd ever read the book by John Perkins, Secrets of an Economic Hitman, where they would come in and get these people into debt, and they could do it numerous ways. But once they got them into debt, then they were at the mercy of whatever the bankers or other circumstances were dealt
Look,
to them.
When I was farming over in the old country, with the introduction of the European Economic Union, I had encountered those kind of shenanigans for years, and I've seen many of my neighbors going under. You know?
Uh-huh.
And when I first came here in the late 60s and so the early 70s, it was a fairly even system here, you know. But then in the mid-70s, here the Department of Agriculture started pulling off the same stunts what I had been familiar with over in the old country. How to do the farmers in. And where I got quite a bit incensed about, then I would hear on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and some of the major networks where they would say, oh, how much longer can we subsidize the small, inefficient farm? And I had the figures about who was getting the subsidies from the government financial reports. So I phoned them up and gave them hell. And I said, if you would have done your homework, you would have seen who is getting the subsidies and the grants. It's not the small, inefficient farmer. It's the big ones. The ones you champion as being an example of prime efficiency. But when they are really that efficient, for what do they need taxpayers' money?
It's amazing the games that they do to try to discourage people from making the other the side that's accomplishing what they should be able to accomplish, the side that isn't accomplishing what they're supposed to be accomplishing, is blaming on the other guy. And
you know something, when I look at one time, the experiences of the older generations were when families were living together several generations, the older people would pass on their experiences onto the younger generation. So the young people wouldn't do the same mistakes again.
Uh-huh.
You know? And I think I got a sneaking suspicion this generation gap was intentionally created so the young people would not learn from the experiences of the elders. So the young people were prone to do the same mistakes again so that they could be exploited again the same way by those by those predators.
Right. And the sad part about it is you know, if we don't step in and stop them, it's like you said, they'll just keep going back generation after generation, doing the same things over and over again. That's why
As I say, you know, now it's not just only about generation after generation doing the same thing over and over again. I don't think there are too many more generations left.
Well, there.
You know, the way things are going.
Right, right. When we get into all the other aspects, but I still wanted to cover a little bit more ground on your background about, you know, about the old country and what kind of experiences you had. Because I just watched a movie recently that was about the Ukraine and it being the breadbasket of Russia, and they were deliberately starved out of...
Because they were mostly family farms, and they did not want to join the collective farms because they realized that in the collective farms, the stewardship of the land went out of the window. And they had enough responsibility to the earth. Some they say Mother Earth, you know,
uh-huh.
That they would not let anything like that happen. And especially, I think, in Russia, you know, the Russian people, you know, Mother Earth, Mother Russia, until that communist Bolshevik rat pack came in.
Now, how did were there any similarities between the German farmer and, because you live near the border, right? Of
That's only 20 miles away from the Iron Curtain.
Okay.
On the western side.
So you probably got a good view of both sides of that, or was there any kind of communication?
Well, you know, lots of refugees came over, and in our community there live many refugees that had come from Eastern Europe, not just only Germans, you know, from Silesia and so, and Sudetenland and so, but a lot of Russians had fled to Germany, Russians, Poles, Eastern European, Lithuania, the Baltic Republics, and so on. You know, there were lots of those people. They had come to Germany, and they found refuge there.
Uh-huh.
You know, and here is something that is not, most people are not aware of. About 20 years ago, a fellow sent me a whole documentary, and people here in North America don't know. The Waffen-SS, there are about 1 million soldiers in there. 600,000 were not Germans. Those were people, soldiers, young men out of the countries that got overrun by the communists, including Russia.
So in other words, what they're doing here, they did there. So they were getting all these people from other countries to come in and act as though they were part of their own...
No. What I mean, you know, when the war started out.
Okay.
And what I understood, Germany was just about to get run over by the communist steamrollers.
Okay.
The same way they had run over the Baltic Republics, the same way they had taken away eastern part of Poland, and... everywhere along the borders, you know, they had taken away half of the eastern half of Finland, you know.
Okay.
And incorporated into their Soviet Union.
So then, in other words, you're saying that they welcomed these other people, too.
Well, as I say, when the war started out, those young men out of those republics that got run over by the communists, they wanted to fight the communists. So they joined the German.
I see. Okay. All right. So.
But as I say, look, we are getting all over the place.
Well, what I'm trying to see is the similarities of what took place back then as to now. Even though we were in agriculture at one point, I mean, when these people, when they go in and take over a country, they take over everything. So,
yeah, and this might be very much of interest to your listener. This was about 30 years ago. I read a report, and according to that, the people in the Soviet Union, they were allowed to have, I think, an acre or something of land, acre or an acre and a half, and that represented about 2.5% of the total agricultural area. And on those 2.5% of agricultural area, they were producing 40% of the food.
So in other words, they were really, being able to...
They were looking after their land.
Right.
Which wasn't the case with the big collective farms. You know, the collective farms, they were hired hands. And anybody who wanted to do some improvement, he had to look over his shoulder if there wasn't some kind of a party official breathing down his neck and who would disapprove of what he, because that party official wanted to take the credit for it. And then anybody who wanted to do some positive improvement, they run the danger of being executed or shipped off to the gulag.
Now, why did you decide you wanted to leave Germany?
Pardon?
Why did you decide you wanted to leave Germany to go to...
Well, we had a small farm, and most of the land was on the lease basis. And the land was scattered around in small fields around a town of roughly about 20,000 people. And the town was rapidly expanding. And I could foresee already the time when there wasn't enough land anymore to go around among us farmers. And then I was getting tired of when I had taken over a lease and I fixed the land up again, got it back into production, and then the owner decided to sell it for building lots, or he decided to give it to another farmer,
Uh-huh.
And at the time, New Brunswick were actively looking for European farmers to come over here, and pick up where the local farmers had left off. But we didn't know what was the reason. The real reason why the local farmers had given up.
So they were dealing with something similar, just a little different twist.
But I wouldn't be surprised if similar shenanigans haven't been going on all over the place. And in the early 70s, when I realized about the deliberate introduction of alien wheat species or insect pests, I thought to myself, within a few years, there was here in the Atlantic region a multi-million dollar market being created for the products of the chemical industry. Because then it became nearly impossible to farm without those agricultural chemicals. But when you have manageable soil in proper tilling practices, you can eliminate most of the weed and pest problems and crop rotations and so. You don't need the chemical crutches.
But I would imagine that most of the farmers over here, though, weren't trained in that style of farming, or were they? Because I thought you said it was...
Well, most of the farmers, the settlers, when they came over here, they still had some of the traditional knowledge. Most of them, they were farmers. They still had some of the traditional knowledge from the old country.
Uh-huh.
But then gradually, over the last 150 years, with so many economic predators, they were being basically financially more and more starved out, and they had to basically buy into the big farming,
mm-hmm.
and into the practices that were not sustainable. just to stay alive. They didn't want to exploit. You know, a real farmer does not want to exploit the soil, you know. Uh-huh. And like the native people understand, they say, is there the saying, whatever you are doing, consider what effect will it have over the next seven generations. And there was an identical spirit over there of the people of the land.
Now,
and now, be they white, be they red, or whatever skin color, the way 150, 200 years ago, the native people were being gradually forced out and mostly eliminated. Now, we the people on the land, we have become now the native people.
And being forced out.
Pardon?
And being forced out.
Yeah.
Okay. So, in other words,
this is what the big wheelers, the big globalists, what they want. They want to uproot the people. And when people don't have any more roots, they don't have any more loyalty, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But the people who still have their roots to their home, to the land and so, they put up a fierce resistance.
Yeah, but at one time, to them, it was advantageous to have people have that ownership. Then they would go in and develop the land and
yeah, until they had done all the hard work, and that's when the money bags figured. Now it's the time when we can move in. You know, the sword busters had busted the sword and cleaned up the fields and dug the stumps out and everything, that the land became arable. And then they started moving in.
Uh-huh.
And then they make use, you know, never let a catastrophe go by unused when the Dust Bowl days.
Okay.
You know?
Well, let me state that this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and my guest this evening is Werner Bock, and he's a farmer in New Brunswick, Canada. And I think we're going to now get into a little bit of the his viewpoint of what's going on in the world. I mean, you've been researching and doing your own looking into what's happening from your perspective. And what would you say? I mean, do you still have family over in Germany still?
Well, my brother's still alive. Both of my sisters have passed away the last 12 years, but I got nieces and nephews.
Are any of them still in agriculture over there?
Well, one of my nieces, my brother's granddaughter.
Uh-huh.
She learned, she is learning, training, agriculture.
Uh-huh. Now, has it changed for them over there, for those that have remained in agriculture over there in Europe, or is it pretty much the same practices that they've always been doing?
No, things have changed, and they don't have, they didn't change for the better.
Uh-huh.
They're exploiting the soil now too much. Where before we were lucky when we called ourselves lucky when we were harvesting a ton and a half or 2 ton per acre, now they're harvesting 4 ton per acre.
So,
and anybody can figure out, you know, sooner or later the soil gets exhausted.
Uh-huh. In other words, they're using a lot of the same practices that we're using over here?
Yeah, and where before there were maybe 20 fields, now you've got one big field of hundreds of acres, maybe
uh-huh.
even 1,000 acres.
So do they have big agri over there?
Yep.
Okay. Now, when the European Union came in there, what were the comments of the people? Did they want that to take place when that...
No, especially not the farming community. Well, the Dutch wanted it.
Uh-huh.
Because they figured it was an economic advantage for them because they had access to the cheap grain from the world market. So they expanded their hog production over all reasons. And they were dumping their surpluses in the other European countries, especially Western Germany. And they did a lot of economic damages to us farmers in Germany. you know.
Uh-huh.
But ultimately, it bites the back into the backside. They expanded their hog production over all reasons, and Holland is lowland with a stagnant aquifer. So they gradually contaminated their drinking water supply, especially with chemicals and especially with estrogen for pigs.
So they were given the pigs hormones?
No. Female pigs extrude the same estrogen as a human being.
Okay. All right.
So I think what I understand, they got the problem of among human beings an increased incidences of gender mix-up.
Okay, but isn't some of that attributed to some of the hormonal...
As I say, estrogen.
Yeah, but I mean that it's in like plastics and things like that.
Yeah, plastic is one of them things, but the other one is from female, especially from female pigs and from human beings too. And this is what they found out in rivers where the sewage goes in.
Uh-huh.
They have among the aquatic figures, they have the same problem.
So they don't have a really good system for dealing with purifying their water and the like?
No, basically, when you have two concentrated livestock operations, there has to be the cycle has to be maintained. The waste has to go back into the land and get recycled as nutrients for the plants that produce the next crop. But how is that possible? When the food is being produced halfway around the world, that nutrient cycle is being disrupted. And
right.
When those nutrients are not being reused, they end up in the groundwater, they end up in the rivers, they end up in the estuaries of the rivers, you know, where they flow into the sea.
Uh-huh.
Then you get massive pollution.
So going back to when they were wanting to make the European Union, were they up front when they did that, or were they trying to be deceitful in...
Well, as I say, they were so deceitful. For example, they always, you know, I don't know if you remember there, Mickey Mouse, the three little ducklings, they wanted to ride into town. But the duckling didn't, the donkey didn't want to go. So one of the smartest little ducklings, he said, oh, we're going to get it. So he got a carrot, tied it to a stick and dangled it in front of the nose of the donkey. And they all hopped onto the donkey, and the donkey ran after the carrot until they were in town. And when they were in town, they all hopped off the donkey, and then the smart ass, he broke the carrot in three, and they all ate the carrot. And then one of the little ducklings said, why did you do that? And the smart ass, he said, going home, he goes home alone. You know, we don't need to dangle a carrot in front of his nose. And this is basically the way they tricked the farmers over there. One of the ways was when the government made economic forecasts, and they said, "Oh yeah, there is a niche. You know, we have to produce more milk." You know,
mm-hmm.
And so they lured the farmers just enough, you know, with a grant so they would expand. You know, build another dairy barn or expand the dairy barn in their dairy herd. And but most of the money the farmers put up by themselves by taking on mortgages and so. And then when they were ready to come with their product on the market, then basically the German government said to all the countries around, anybody got any surpluses? Bring them all in. And guess what happened? The bottom dropped right out of the price for milk and milk products. And so many more farmers bit the dust.
So very much the same thing happened over here with the getting people to get use their equity in their homes and right. So
as I say, I was aware of it when I was farming over the old country through the 60s. You know.
Uh-huh.
And my father is he was a pretty smart man, and he was, active in the agricultural organization, you know. And one thing what he always said, you know, the ones the farmers elected to represent them in their agricultural organization, they were selling them out.
So the same tactics, maybe with different...
Pardon?
The same tactics then were in place for them.
I remember when I was, I don't know, I was about 17 years old. First time I went with my farmer to a meeting, with my father to a meeting, the annual meeting, and my dad, he brought up some points, and the ones that were thickened with the government, that were basically on the subsidy cross, on the grand cross, you know, they were shouting him down, you know, try to ridicule him. And then when I went back in 1973, one of my neighbors, who a few years earlier was of the in crowd, then he was on the out crowd, and he said, "We were fools. We should have supported your dad." But he said, "Now it's too late."
So what do you, where do you think the direction of is Canada dealing with some things that are different than here in the United States, or?
Well, as I say, you know, when Prime Minister Harper got elected, some they called him. They were making basically a competition. What kind of a nickname would they want to give him? So this one fellow, I remember, he phoned up and we should call him Shrub. So the talk show host, he asked him, why do you want to call him Shrub? And the guy said, "Well, you know, Shrub is a little bush."
But that's in Canada, right?
That's in Canada.
Okay, so what time period are we speaking of here?
Pardon?
What time period are we speaking of here now?
This was about when President Bush, you know.
Okay, all right.
Second Gulf War?
All right, when George Bush Jr. was...
Yeah, after 9/11.
Oh, okay, with George Bush Jr. Are you... One of the things that I've noticed over here, I mean, we have our Air Force is called the Northern Command, and it looks like we've got Canadian forces combined with American forces, which in a sense is like saying we're one.
Well, as I say, you know, one fellow years ago, he said, you know, good neighbors make good fences.
Meaning?
And good neighbors, they have secure borders with their neighbors.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
You know? Otherwise, you know, too many bad things can happen, what you see there on your southern border.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to allude to here is how they subtly start changing the names and start blending terminology and language.
Yeah, basically, who is it? Sybil Edmonds, you know, she got the boiling frog blog.
Uh-huh.
You know, how do you boil a frog? Slowly you turn up the heat. And by the time the frog realizes that he's cooked, he can't move anymore.
Right. So when you have, you have like your United States Navy's now saying America's Navy, you have... The kids are getting taught in school about the global world. It's those borders that are being blended away. And
look, especially when we are dealing with this worldwide, I call them a wolf pack, economic raiders, international wolf pack. They plunder one region, one country after another. And then they move over to the next country, to the next region. They devastate one sheepfold after another. And when you are dealing with this kind of a situation, you don't open the border. You close the border and you hunt down the predators.
But unfortunately, at this point in time, I mean, I don't. Is a lot of the tactics what we're seeing here is you see with the tactics of how this country is being they socialized or there are those, I mean, you can use whatever ism you want to it, but they're blending us into the same system that it seems to be prevalent in Russia and China.
See, you are at the same point of time, and it was just possible that the United States could last that long because of your immense resources. But you are now at the same point of time Germany was by the end of the 20s, the early 30s. The country was dying. And there was civil war, and you had all the different factions, from the communists to the ones that were willing to fight for the emperor, to the National Socialists. Basically, the National Socialists, it became a grassroots movement where they marshaled the resources, and the biggest resource in the country is the working people, in order to get the cart back on the road.
So was that a kind of a case of when a Hegelian dialectic, where the problem, reaction, solution? In other words,
no, I don't think so? In that case it was that way. Nonetheless, the ones who set up those conditions,
Mm-hmm.
But then basically in Germany they threw the monkey wrench in, they kicked the bankers out. And where in the Hegelian dialectic they wanted to profit from the problems that have been created, so they got kicked out, and that peeved them off.
So they just went to Plan B.
Yeah.
Because if you don't let them in and say...
And as I say, it has been repeated time and time, especially in the last 20 years. All the different countries that didn't want to buy into the IMF, into the International Monetary Fund,
Mm-hmm.
They got bombed into submission.
Well, it's so interesting that, when you start listening to as many radio programs and experts as I have over the last few years, you get to the point where it isn't so much identifying who and what, there's a system in place that we have to kind of break through, and not sitting there identifying all these different groups and people, but breaking the system and thought processes of people and habits of people that support these systems.
Well, the animals that are designated to be prey for the predators, the animals that are able to predict the movements of the predators, are the ones that have the most chance to survive.
And are we going to have enough of people doing that?
Well, this is right now it is in the balance. But I think there is one thing with the predators: they become too arrogant. Too many of them, they think they have become invincible. But here we never shall let out all those Frankensteins in the laboratories, all those predators. They couldn't do all the evil deeds if they wouldn't have their armies of Frankensteins in the laboratories.
And you're meaning when you're saying that?
All the mad scientists.
I've seen some really interesting interviews lately of old film footage of some of these scientists that were back 40, 50 years ago doing experimentation on mind and experimentation on diseases and things like that, and those that would appear to be some of them just literally thought...
They're outright sick experiments.
Yes, they were.
And how come that none of them is in jail or being executed?
Because they were hired to do that.
They didn't give this much grace to the, for example, the German prisoner of war under General Eisenhower, or in the in the Russian gulags or in the French coal mines.
I mean, when you realize that they can experiment on humans, and those that are taught this is the process and this is the way you go about doing this procedure and whatever, even though, you know, when you look at it on its face, it's very inhumane, and yet you watch them do it day after day after day because they've been shown that as the way to do something, and we don't even have the ability to use our own brains and stand back and say, something's not right about this. Why are we doing this?
And my question is, how can Bill Gates or Dr. Eric Pianka and some of those mad scientists openly asking for the elimination of up to 90% of the world's population?
And they believe
it. Is that a criminal offense? Advocating mass murder?
Right. It's just amazing to watch how we can't...
They're not in jail? Or in a mental institution for the criminally insane?
Well, that is one of the most interesting things about looking at the mass mind and how we can be supposedly fighting terrorism or supposedly fighting, you know, crime, and yet crime doesn't go down, it goes up.
Basically fighting the devil with a Beelzebub. And it never works out. And now we come to the situation where we need protections from the protectors.
Right. No, you're exactly right. So do you have many people in your area that are starting to figure all this out, or do you feel like you're still, you know, alone in this?
Most of the people around here, look, Canadians have been living for several hundred years as colonial subjects. And I try to explain why so many people are so laid back. And as colonial subjects, it's the next worst thing than living underneath a dictatorship. And in Canadian history, anybody who opened up his mouth or stood up to the colonial master, he either got hanged or executed or got driven out. So you basically get a kind of natural selection. You don't have many people left, you know, to speak out. But in order to release their frustration, they project a foreign enemy. For example, let's go after the Muslims. Or two world wars. Let's go after the Germans. Or let's go after Iraq. Let's go after Libya. Let's go after Afghanistan.
Yeah, but there's no difference than us who supposedly didn't, you know, thought that we were free.
I remember there... during the Falklands Wars, the Argentinian dictator, he was in big trouble. So he started the Falkland Wars in order to draw attention from his internal troubles in Argentina.
But he drew more people into it.
He wanted to, marshal the national spirit of the people and focus it on an enemy from abroad.
Uh-huh.
When in reality, the biggest enemy was his regime.
Well, it seems like the Argentinians keep going through their own internal economic collapses on about every 20 years or so, right?
Well, I remember there one German fellow, he lived for... Oh, this must have been about 50 years ago, he said. He had immigrated at first to Argentina, and he was living in Patagonia, and he was managing a sheep farm. But he said, you know, when they had a revolution there, out in the countryside, we wouldn't notice anything. Next time we would come in town, they would tell us, oh yeah, we got another government.
So they just changed government.
At the time, what he said, most of the revolutions they played out in the bigger cities.
Uh huh.
You know,
So were they more like coups? No.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, something in that line.
Uh-huh. But I do remember that they also went through a period of time when they were losing a lot of people.
Yeah, as I say, under this dictator they had, I don't remember his name, when during the Falkland Wars, thousands of people, they disappeared.
Uh-huh.
And that's when they developed this identified the human remains, the DNA.
But that practice has been done by numerous regimes around the world as well.
Well, as I say, the one who is without guilt, let him cast the first stone.
So
that's what the Lord said when they wanted to stone that woman.
Mm-hmm.
And the Pharisees and all the ones that had gathered around were willing to stone her, to kill her. They all shied away. The Lord was alone with the woman, and he asked her, "Where are thine accusers?" And the woman said, "They all left, Lord." So he said to her, "Neither do I accuse you. Go home and sin no more."
So are there other farmers that are working together in Canada, or one or two here or there that are, is Percy Schmeiser still active, or?
Well, he is now in his late 70s.
Uh-huh.
But look, I just started out here. Percy Schmeiser, it was a well-established farm, and he had, well-run business, and I just started out, and when I came here, I had to lay the groundwork, get an infrastructure going.
Mm-hmm.
But when they kept messing around with my fields, then I spent a lot of work in the forest and was doing silviculture work. And I figured, well, if they mess up in order to make up the deficit, so I derive part of my income from the forest. But now with this big company basically holding the monopoly on forestry, now the beef is in the toilet and the forestry is in the toilet.
How's the water situation up there?
Oh, so far, we got lots of water, and most of it is good water. Not like in your neck of the woods that is very precious, the water situation. But I wonder, when all that junk, what they're dispersing up there in the sky from the chemtrails, when that is going to do its toll.
Mm-hmm.
We might run into some problem with the water.
Well,
I get my water from a spring in the hillside,
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the people that get their water from a water source out of a deep aquifer, maybe that won't be affected as fast.
You're not having a lot of private companies come in and take up the water in Canada?
Not so much here on the East Coast. Most of the communities, they got their own water supply. They either got their own springs, but here, for example, the city of Moncton is a city of roughly about 100,000 people. They derive their water out of an open water reservoir.
Uh-huh.
And I phoned them up and I said, "Test your water with those chemtrail sprays. You might get into trouble." The same way, city of St. John, they derive their drinking water out of several lakes.
Uh-huh. Do you think they've been testing it to see if it's been affecting them?
Well, as I say, what I've seen so far, when I phoned up the Department of the Environment and made them aware of the chemtrails and of the results from Arizona Skywatch.
Uh-huh.
The guy didn't have a clue. And then he wanted to give me another phone number. I said, "I'm not gonna go on a runaround. You pass it to the ones in your department who is responsible for it."
So obviously then it isn't just the department heads and whatever that aren't familiar with this.
As I say, how much of the warning do the people get on the West Coast about the up to five times increased radiation levels from Fukushima.
Right.
You know?
Uh-huh.
Do the authorities in Arizona warn the public about all the toxic materials, particulates that are coming out of the chemtrails that people breathe in?
But yeah, but that's not just Arizona that's going through.
Yeah,
that.
As I say, it's worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
There's a California Skywatch and then Long Island Skywatch, and I've made some pictures in British Columbia. There's a friend of mine, Alex Hunter, and him and his network, they've been documenting it, and I made a bunch of pictures over the last couple of years about chemtrails. Very marked pictures, chemtrails, and then manipulation with HAARP. They're on Facebook.
Right. So, as far as the forest, are they being affected by any of these whatever's coming out of the chemtrails there?
What forest does it, on your side of the wood, of the border? What they've been realize now the last years with this, especially the aluminum,
uh-huh,
dust settled on the tree branches and on the foliage and so, when they get forest fires, they burn a lot hotter because the aluminum dust makes a lot hotter fire.
And so they're finding that the levels of aluminum is much higher than
plus
on these.
The aluminum is toxic to the soil. And we don't have to worry. Here along comes Monsanto to the rescue with GM-modified aluminum-resistant crops.
Now, what would be their reason for having that if they're supposedly not putting anything in these things that are coming? Are they trying to just say that it's just lots of aluminum out there and it just dispersed all over and we should nature should have been...
That's right now it's guesswork. But there is maybe a multifaceted approach. They want to achieve different goals with basically creating this layer of metal particulates there.
Because I literally have
out of the box.
I literally have heard arguments them saying that there really are natural. I mean, aluminum apparently comes about being naturally high out there in the environment. And
look, if you can bear with me for a moment.
Okay.
I got the list here from, are you familiar with the list from Dr. Perlingeri and Arizona Skywatch?
I'm not familiar with the doctor, but I'm a little bit familiar with Arizona Skywatch.
I got the list right here.
Okay.
I think it was 2 years ago or 3 years ago when they did air sample testing at ground level after heavy chemtrail spray.
Uh-huh.
And they found out the aluminum levels were 15.8 times above the allowable toxic limit. The antimony levels were 63.3 times. The arsenic levels were 418 times above the allowable toxic limit as laid down by EPA.
Okay,
barium, 5.3 times. Cadmium, 6 times. Chromium, 6.4 times. Copper, 9 times. Iron, 43.5 times. Lead, 15.7 times. And manganese, 513.8 times. And manganese, not to be mistaken with magnesium, manganese is a very powerful neurotoxin, more potent than lead or mercury. And the level was 513.8 times above the allowable toxic limit.
Okay, then if you're saying that they were spraying, this was being sprayed, then these limits had to keep going up, right?
And people were breathing those levels in, getting them in their lungs and into their body. And one thing what they found out about manganese, about 20 years ago, I was in contact with a member of parliament about a different issue, and he forwarded the issue I brought to his attention to the agriculture critic, Ralph Ferguson, and at the time he wanted to have manganese banned as a fuel additive. And there were some science reports. What they had found out, people that were exposed to high levels of manganese are 10 times more prone to commit violent crimes than those people who were not exposed. They found that out in South America. Manganese miners, they had 10 times the rate of violent crimes, including murder, than the rest of the population. And in Australia, there were Aborigines living near a site where there was a manganese mine and lots of manganese dust in the air. What they were breathing in, they had the same problem there.
So what are the reasons for, what are they attributing this to? I mean, is it multifaceted?
But you don't get that from all those experts.
Okay, so...
But look, we have been going over so many different things. May I retract again about when we're talking about the ranches in Colorado?
Uh-huh.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
What did I want to say?
You were saying something about the ranches.
Oh, yeah. You know, what I understood there with Wagner's cattle, they got they went astray on the other side of the mountain.
Uh-huh.
Couldn't have access to it. Now, I remember that in the 50s, sometimes over there in the old country, we would see pictures when for example, in Colorado, Arizona or so, you know, in the Midwest and so, cattle got stranded or horses got stranded. Then the militaries would move in and drop hay.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Right. Now, one of the things when I did talk to an animal control officer, his comment was that we had two different styles of dealing with the issues that were kind of in conflict here. And Vern would have been from the one school, and then you have another school of thought.
Well, they want complete confinement housing in big feedlots and everything. And you know where the trouble started out with BSE.
Okay.
It started out in the big feedlots that were being run by the big companies.
Right.
You know? And that's where they had the vertical integration with the slaughterhouses, feed mills and everything. And they were using the slaughterhouse waste, grinding it up, and putting it back into the cattle feed.
Isn't that amazing?
And then on top of that, they were importing slaughterhouse waste from Australia, from sheep. And sheep have something similar to mad cow disease.
Uh-huh.
Or bovine spongiform encephalopathy. It's called scrappy.
Right.
And they were putting that into the feed.
So if they're willing to do that to the animal...
That the farmers were doing it and the ranchers were doing it. And I said to one reporter here, I said when they were harping about and wanted to blame it on the farmers, I said, I've been around for over 50 years around farms. And I never, when I came into a farmyard, I saw a big cauldron there where the farmers would throw the dead cows or the dead animals in and feed them back to the livestock.
Amazing. And if they're willing to do that to the animals, do you think that it's not that big of a step to start doing similar things to us?
Don't they do that already with human fetuses?
Yes. I mean, when you that's where this whole thought process is. You know, where do you draw the line of what should be acceptable behavior, and how does the human body, you know, or the...
Having respect for the human beings, having respect for creatures.
Right.
Back to the cattle.
Mm-hmm.
What I understand, that area is dotted with all kind of military installation.
We've got a number.
What I see here, where most of my animals were being killed, they were being killed with lasers. And one of the most deadly way of killing them was where they focused a heat producing and a UV frequency onto the nose of the animals and modify the atmospheric air. And by oxidizing the nitrogen and changing ozone into oxygen, They basically created a very deadly, corrosive gas with high concentration of ozone and nitrogen oxides.
So they were able to focus that and
it can be done from miles away.
Okay,
A few years ago when I was on Darren Week's show on Republic Broadcasting Network, one guy, he phoned up over there. He said he had been stationed over there in Germany. And he said the soldiers, they would have some fun. They would use the laser sights on the Abrams tanks and focus it on the blackbirds that outside the base were sitting in the trees and basically cooking them alive, and then they would fall down.
So then you're saying that what was happening to your cows was something similar to maybe cattle mutilations of sorts?
I have it documented, and there is a 75-minute documentary on the Internet.
Uh-huh. Where would they find that at?
Just Google my name, Werner Bock, and the word ordeal, O-R-D-E-A-L, and then look electronic attack cattle.
Uh-huh.
And it's a four-part.
Okay, so you've got pictures of what was happening to your animals?
My friend Alexander and Irene Royers. Alexander, his website is Joker Tattoo. He got all four parts in this website. And Irene, I think she got all four parts. But people worldwide, within a few weeks, they picked it up and posted in their website. When I encountered the massive cover-up by the veterinarians, I had to stop to find out what was killing the animals. So I started doing autopsies, and that's when I got quite a wake-up call.
Uh-huh.
And I took photos, I documented it, and then I researched it. I started putting the things together, and then to make sure I wasn't way out in left field, I contacted some of the scientists who had done the research and whose research was being published, for example, in PubMed, you know, already decades ago, to make sure I wasn't way out in left field. And it all confirmed. But I, as a layperson, had already concluded.
Uh-huh.
But with the veterinarians, most of them here, the majority, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink.
Right. So you can easily find Werner Bock's electronic attack cattle mutilation ordeal on the Internet. So if you want to watch the documentation of what you were dealing with, and you've done several programs with other talk show hosts on this subject. Is there
just a couple of weeks ago they killed another cow.
Oh, you're still dealing with it then?
I'm still dealing with it. And I noticed wherever that animal, this one day she was standing in a part of the yard, whenever I was around there, I would get severe burning in my lungs, and immediately I would get severe pains in my armpits, radiating right down, especially in the left hand.
So it's like a microwave?
No.
No?
The lungs are damaged. So when you breathe in, what caused the burning? Nitrogen oxide. And since the lungs are damaged, it passes right into the bloodstream and corrodes the blood vessels from the inside, which causes the pain.
So that does it to the animals, and it does it to you as well, right?
What kills a 1,500-pound cow or 1,800-pound cow is no trouble killing a 150-pound human being.
Right.
And what those monsters have done to those animals, anybody who watches that full documentary. And then, this has been a technology that has been around for nearly 60 years. And the point I'm making now, where I'm going after the law enforcement, I said it does not take the criminal element 60 years to catch up with new technology. You guys, you want to be paid by today's pay standards. You won't be satisfied with getting the paycheck you got 60 years ago. So why should we be satisfied with services from you guys based on technology from 60 years ago?
Well, now they've probably got something much worse and more...
Well, as I say, this is... when I first encountered it, I found out I wasn't the only farmer that put in the loony bin. There was another farmer a year and a half earlier, just only 70 miles away. He had lost 65 head of cattle. Same cover-up. He had a well-run dairy farm, you know, and he had lost 65 head of cattle. He had sued someone. He had a well-known former mayor of Moncton and later on member of parliament, Leonard Jones. He had him as a lawyer, but the case got thrown out of court. The next day he was being picked up by the RCMP and put in the same loony bin, assigned to the same young immigrant doctor from Bangladesh and Dr. Alam, who barely spoke English, supposed to be suffering from paranoia. Things like that don't happen in New Brunswick. And I thought to myself, what better patsy could they find than this young immigrant doctor? He sure didn't want to get sent back to Bangladesh. Just a few weeks earlier, when I spoke to two young students from Kenya, at the time they were keeping track of me, and they had told me that they had to stay another year in Canada. They were studying to become teachers, and they wanted to go back to Kenya. 2 days later, they were standing in the lobby of the student resident, ready to leave for Kenya. They shipped them out. She was crying. You know, her name was Valerie, and his name was Stephen. And I said, Valerie, why are you crying? And Stephen, the other young fella, he said, Werner, don't worry. Things will turn out all right.
So,
and at the time, the lawyer, a year and a half earlier, he had told to the other farmer, we cannot do anything against this bunch. They even work with computers. And that was, I think, 1973. And in 1973, computers were at the cutting edge of technology.
Sorry.
A year later, a Mountie, there was a new Mountie here in the village, and he came to see me one night, and we were talking. And he said, oh, you just must have got into one of their rallies. He said, last year they started up in Nova Scotia. This year they are in New Brunswick, and that's the way it will go all across the country. You know, like a popular movement. But then he added, you know, people are getting greedy. That indicated the criminal element. And what we are dealing with is organized crime at the highest level and at the lowest levels. That's where it comes in, organized stalking, gang stalking, electronic stalking, and there are at least 1 million people right across North America that are victim of this crime. And when they speak out, they got a good chance of being picked up and put into the mental institution and drugged up.
So is there a way that people can deal with this? How is it that you've been able to...
Well, as I say, you know, I collected evidence, and then attacked, and then put the word out.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But on several occasions over the years, you know, they tried to set me up, and I must have had a guardian angel, otherwise I would have had a deadly accident.
Now, are you in touch with other people across this country? That
yeah, on both sides of the border, and
uh-huh.
Over there in Germany, too.
So this isn't just isolated. They do
no,
it all over.
No, this is worldwide.
Why would they do that? I mean, what purpose does it...
Well, I think what's coming down the pipe, you know, one world government, globalization... It's just a front for the kingdom of the Antichrist. But in the mid-70s, so many of the mainstream churches, they were lying to the people. They were telling them, before the tribulation comes, you're all going to get raptured. You're going to get picked up. You don't go through the tribulation. And that was a lie. When you read Mark 13 and Matthew 24, it came right from the lips of the Lord. But people were buying it, hook, line, and sinker because it made them feel good. And what we are dealing with is a satanic movement. And I've encountered so many of them, I used to track them down, and as long as they hadn't figured out who they were and what they were up to, they were just gloating, you know, and you could see the devilishness right out of their eyes. The more evil things they did, the more they delighted in it. But when I found out what they were up to and who they were, and then I would tell everybody around, the next time I saw them, they looked like a dog somebody had kicked in the behind.
So in other words,
they got punished by their own clique for being so stupid and having been found out, and in that way endangering their whole network.
And one of the things that I've run across, you know, I mean, when you're talking about it, on the bottom, I mean, it seems like the underbelly of them is where they're most...
the underbelly of humanity.
Mm-hmm. Is where they're most vulnerable, and any time that dealing with some of the human trafficking and drugs and things like that, when you have they utilize the people on the bottom and keep them there, and they feed their way up to the top.
But when people are put in fear,
mm-hmm.
they will do some of the most horrendous things,
right?
Either in fear of their own life or to protect the life of some of their loved ones,
right? And or just so that they have, you know, they can eat. I mean, they can. It's not that hard to pressure somebody.
You probably have read about what happened there over the years in Africa with the child soldiers,
right?
You know.
But that's not just happening, you know, that same tactic is somewhat used in the gangs.
Yeah.
And over here in central...
As I say, you know, too many people, they think it, over the years I encountered a kind of an attitude, oh, just keep your head low and let it blow over. It will blow over. But it didn't blow over, and it won't blow over this time.
You just continually are losing your cattle, and it hasn't scared you out of trying to continue on, or how are you dealing with this kind of attack?
Look, I did not think that it would have been that kind of a long battle,
mm-hmm.
and I'm trying to protect my animals as much as possible, you know.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, I have to stay in the battle, you know, because I found out so many things, and it's getting close that the things are coming out. And if I bail out now, it's basically like, what's the word? Right now my brain doesn't work. You know, when
you're staying up pretty late because
a soldier hightails out of there. Desert.
Oh, deserting. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you started at 11 o'clock your time, and it's getting close to 1 o'clock. You're doing pretty good. So.
We're in the
last stretch here. So.
As I say, I didn't. Last Sunday morning they got me real good.
What'd they do?
And, I'm trying to shake it off, you know. Woke up with a real bad cold, but there's another myth about the colds.
And what is that? You know?
But people share, watch that DVD, that documentary.
Uh-huh. Again, that's...
It debunks a lot of the myths that's been spread by so many doctors. When I brought it to the attention of a local doctor here at the medical center, and a week later I phoned up, I said, did you have a look at it? She said to me, I don't have time for your pet project.
Huh. And this, again, this video, and you just type in Werner, W-E-R-N-E-R, Bach, B-O-C-K, and ordeal, and that'll bring up numerous different stories about...
So you get electronic attack cattle, and the title of the DVD of the documentary is Farmer's Ordeal.
So did you produce it or somebody else?
Well, I had a fellow help me. It still got a few rough edges, but I ran out of money to do any more editing. But then I figured, you know, it comes from a farmer. There are so many polished productions available, and that way, when it got a few rough edges, it looks more original.
Uh-huh.
You know.
And is there are there any other farmers like you that are or ranchers like you that are hanging in there and still at it, or do they?
Not to the extent I've been doing it.
Uh-huh. I mean, you're quite active because I've heard you on many, many radio programs.
Well, I'm trying to get the word out. You know, get people to wake up.
Uh-huh.
And with the wars that are going on, people have to finally stand up to the leaders who sent the soldiers to wars. Your minister, he's a defense minister, minister of defense. So are the ministers in all the other NATO countries, including Canada. They're not minister of war. And how did most of those countries, can they justify destroying a country, killing millions of people? They did not get attacked by Iran or by Iraq or by Afghanistan or by Libya. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But there is this, I don't know, sometimes people here in North America, they have to bite the bullet, but I encountered the same thing with my relatives over there in Germany now. Too many of them, they think the military can't do any wrong.
Isn't that amazing? So can we, with your research on around this cattle mutilation, what is your feelings why they would target them in such a manner?
Well, initially, they figured they could pull it off within half a year and I would have been out of there. But it didn't quite work. And now they got basically an example has to be statuated to scare the hell right out of people or anybody who dares to resist them.
Well, you know, Werner, I think we're getting to the point of the end of the program here, and if we got any conclusions as to, you know, your work, I mean, because you've been dealing with this in your agricultural work and your ranching work, and...
See, I look at the basic figures.
Mm-hmm.
When I came over from Germany... We had about 240 people per square kilometer, and we were producing roughly about 90% of the food. So we were producing food for over 200 people per square kilometer.
Mm-hmm.
And on your side of the border, you got, what, 34 people per square kilometer? And you can't produce any more your own food? There's something wrong there. Here in Canada... we got 3.4 people per square kilometer. Here in New Brunswick, we got 10 people per square kilometer. And we are producing food for only a little bit than one person per square kilometer.
Wow. How's the water?
And that, considering all the millions of dollars that have been wasted over the years for Department of Agriculture and the paychecks, for the experts in the Department of Agriculture, what the stupid farmers were able to accomplish before, and most of them, they had to leave school after the third or fourth grade and work on the farm. They were able to feed the people. But now with all this expertise, only producing about 10% of the food, and on the other side there, on your side of the border in Maine, a few months ago I spoke to a lady in Maine, and I said, by the way, how much self-sufficiency in food production do you have in Maine? And she said, can you believe it? At one time we were exporting food to the cities on the eastern seaboard. And she said, now we are importing 90% of the food.
Wow.
And what I'm saying, basically want to say, big government is not the solution. Big government only leads to big mismanagement.
It doesn't matter what form of government, then.
Pardon?
And it doesn't matter what form of government.
As I say, the communist governments, they were even worse. Russia, they got, what, 8.1 or 8.3 people per square kilometer? And they're about, 20, 30 years ago, they had to import grain. They couldn't even produce any more enough grain for their own people. Something wrong.
Right.
If they leave it, and it is a multi-generational commitment, for the farming families, and that way they become stewards of the land. And we cannot leave the stewardship of the land in the hands of multinational corporations and fly-by-night outfits and this international predator pack that roams around the globe. They got no loyalties to any country, to any society. But one thing what I had detested very much when my trouble first started out, a lot of people, they knew what was going on, but nobody warned me. And I said, look, animals, when there is a predator around, they give out a warning cry. But this ingrown instinct seemed to be, and sense of duty seemed to be lost among the human race, among most of them.
Wow, isn't that amazing?
And how can the so-called born-again Christians call themselves born-again Christians and not do that and warn their fellow men? The best I would get from the people was some kind of a vague hint, like a riddle.
Isn't that amazing?
Well, if they got, if they can afford the luxury of shrouding everything in riddles,
mm-hmm.
And some of them, they think they can make a joke out of it. In the end, most of the jokers, they're going to find out the joke is on them.
Well, Werner, I'm going to call it an evening here and state that I appreciate...
Excuse me.
And state that I appreciate you staying up late and filling us in on your experiences there.
Well, as I say, we went all over the place, but hopefully it will be helpful to your listeners.
Right. I hope that you're able to weather this and find some support, and that we'll continue to try to get the word out more among what we're dealing with. I mean, that's...
And as I say, at least one-third of the predator, the ones I was dealing with here,
uh-huh.
They came from the militaries. They either were wannabe soldiers, teenagers,
uh-huh.
That were too young to join the army, or militaries.
That's who you're saying...
Silent helicopters.
Oh, okay. I see what you're talking about.
And big military jet planes and transport planes.
Uh-huh.
Like Hercules.
Okay.
This one, it was a dark green Hercules, come from Gagetown. As soon as they came to the bottom of the property, was a slight wind come from the west. It was around noontime. Then he flew right parallel, upwind from the pasture, until he came to the upper end of the farm. And I thought he would clip the pine tree on the ridge, but shortly before he reached the pine trees, he revved up a little bit, and within maybe 4 feet. He hopped over the top of the pine trees.
Mm-hmm.
And in the afternoon, the cattle wouldn't touch the grass anymore.
Really? Did that affect, you know, your health as well?
Well, as I say, they ruined my lungs. And I am just trying to stay alive.
Uh-huh. Well, again, I want to thank you, Werner, and keep up the good work and keep...
Well, I try to hang in as long as I can. And people have to see the bigger picture. And what we are dealing with here is, the next thing is the kingdom of the Antichrist. And what we are dealing with here is Satanists. And that's where the chemtrails come in, and all this stuff. It's not just only, you know, poisoning people and so on. But what I figure, like, created like a huge reflector screen and like a huge reflector sound stage, so they can pull off that big show in the sky.
Well, I've covered a little bit of these.
You have heard about Blue Beam?
Yeah, Project Bluebeam, yes.
Yeah, and then all over the world, people hear something like trumpets in the sky.
Right. There's so many... When you start trying to deal with putting the truth out there, there's so many different rabbit...
They're not just only following up one purpose. It's a multi-purpose approach with one action. We got to say, you know, you slap as many flies as they can. With one slap is a fly swatter.
Right. Again, well, I want to thank you again, Werner, and I want to say good night. And
you're welcome.
Okay.
And I appreciate that you got the show and that you invited me to your show.
Okay, and thank you.
So you have a good evening, and may the Lord protect you.
And you too. Good night.
Good night.